From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a close look at the situation on the ground in Syria, the prospects for the ceasefire, and the sharp deterioration in already bad relations between the U.S. and Russia, by speaking with senior lecturer in international relations at Moscow State University, retired U.S. Naval officer Mark Sloboda. That was some show at the U.N. on Saturday.
It was a circus. It is a crazy, nasty circus. I think there were some dramatics on both sides, but particularly despicable, of course, on Power's side. She walked out first when the Russian envoy Churkin was speaking, and then he repeated the same for her, both of them going to speak to the press while each other was delivering their address on the subject. Powers called it a stunt, as complaining about U.S. Air Force or U.S. and coalition. There's been some talk that some the Australians and UK and Denmark were involved, but there's a lot of reasons to doubt that any of that is true. They attacked. They are in Syria illegally. They attacked Syrian government forces and killed dozens. The final death count may be up around 80. Yeah. And they basically were providing close air support for ISIS. And Powers made a statement that the conflict in Syria is confusing, and made a reference that it was a mistake in the fog of war. And this is true. The conflict in Syria is multi-sided, multi-sides fighting each other in other places, but not there.
Yeah.
Not in the east, not in Deir ez-Zor. There are two sides there. It is ISIS, and it is the Syrian government. Right. And this Deir ez-Zor, the small city there, there's about close to 200,000 people. It has basically been a fortress under siege for years by ISIS. It has thrown back the number of assaults that has thrown back is surely well over 100. God bless the people that are living there. There for having held out. It's almost someday you could write an epic Hollywood flick about if it wasn't, of course, for the fact that it was Syrian government forces defending the town and the people there. You could write an epic story of the defense of Deir ez-Zor. This is in the east. It's to the east of Syria, east central, and it's in the direction towards ISIS held Raqqa, and they basically paved the way for an assault by ISIS. ISIS attacked during and immediately after the coalition airstrike on the Syrian government forces. Right. And as a result, were briefly able to take a strategic mountaintop that gave them a direct artillery firing line on the city and its defenses. This was rebuffed within the next 24 hours with help from the Russian Air Force.
Right.
But the suggestion that this was a mistake is ludicrous. The U.S. has not routinely conducted any strikes in this area, and certainly haven't recently, obviously because, as always, they have always let ISIS expand whenever it's up against the Syrian government. They have never supported the Syrian government. But there was an incident nearly 2 years ago now in approximately the same area where another coalition strike hit Syrian government forces. It was quietly kind of wiped away at the time. There were suggestions that it was maybe the Saudis or the Qataris who have since stopped flying over East Syria or so on. But this is not the first attack on government forces in the area. But this is the first one that they have actually admitted happened, at the least.
There's some things that are interesting to me about this. There was a little showmanship, I guess, that also came from Ambassador Churkin, but that is completely uncharacteristic of him. And in some parts when he was speaking, you could hear his voice quivering. He was really, you know, he was very angry. Things that caught my attention, one was his just curt response to a question about, was there a real possibility of an engagement between Russian and American airplanes at that point? And he said, I have no information on that. And that was it. And the other, which was related, was he mentioned, as you just mentioned, that the Russian Air Force came in and defended the Syrian troops on the ground. That's pretty scary.
Of course, it is extremely scary. And there are some unconfirmed reports, and I want to repeat unconfirmed, that there might have been some Russian special forces advising the Syrian troops there. And if that was the case, that would go further to explaining Churkin's fury. But we'll consider that unconfirmed for the moment. The U.S. says that as soon as they were informed by Russia that they were striking Syrian government forces, which is kind of a no-duh, it is impossible to believe. The U.S. proudly talks about its, you know, its smart bombs and its precision airstrikes all the time. There are U.S. drones, you know, or coalition drones. They were over the whole area in the days leading up to this attack and beforehand. I don't think anyone can really seriously suggest that this was a mistake. Even Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, tweeted briefly that this was the U.S. sending a message to the Russians, and then deleted the tweet. But of course, it was captured in screen grabs.
You know, another scary component to that was basically the entire presentation, both inside and outside the council chambers, by Power. She said at the beginning, well, we think it was a mistake, we're investigating it. And then the rest of the time, she laid out this diatribe, sarcastic, and not dealing with the fact that, oops, by the way, you know, that kind of a mistake could have led to World War III. Instead, she goes on the offensive.
Yeah, it was a pretty, I mean, Powers is not a professional diplomat. I mean, she's another one of these activists put into the position of a professional diplomat, which is, you know, like Kerry with Lavrov, I again, with the U.S., is one of the reasons why I think Russian diplomats, while usually appearing more restrained and conservative, also at the same time dance rings around their U.S. opponents because they're professionals. But Powers was especially unhinged and really did not do the U.S. any credit, even in this this defense of the undefensible. She only made the situation worse and got positively hysterical.
Let me just contextualize that. I mean, for our listeners, what happened was Russia called a special emergency session of the council because the United States, whether accidentally, as it claims, or intentionally, broke the ceasefire agreement that was just coming into fruition and attacked illegally the Syrian army. And Power turns around and says, okay, we're going to look into that and see if we did it, then starts attacking the Syrian government and Russia with a bunch of fabricated stuff that's been disproven. And then at the end of it says, and everything that Churkin said is essentially intended to deflect from the core point.
Yeah.
Doing exactly what she was accusing Churkin of.
I think actually we could probably pay too much attention to Power's speech simply because it was intended to deflect from what is really going on. First of all, is this attack. And there is suggestions, and I think they're within the realm of possibility, that this is the result of some kind of institutional infighting in the United States.
Churkin brought that up, and that's scary.
Yes, Churkin
said,
yeah, that
who's
in charge? That is scary, because that puts a potential World War III scenario, you know, even closer and more out of control.
Who's in control?
It's well known that Obama is a lame duck.
But he said
he is at odds with his State Department, his Pentagon, his CIA, his defense secretary, his secretary of state on Syria policy. He, as far as we can tell, was the one pushing for this ceasefire agreement.
Right.
The defense secretary, Ashton Carter, has very publicly made his opposition to it known. In fact, even suggested that he wasn't sure whether he would actually have the military obey it, even as Obama was signing up to it, which is again scary. And there we don't know, but it could very well be that this was a act by the military or some people within it intending to break the ceasefire. Whether that was done with the White House's permission or not, we don't know.
Right.
But certainly the U.S. government, the foreign policy elite, or factions within the U.S. government, including, again, very specifically the Secretary of Defense, have made their opposition to this ceasefire known very clearly, very loudly, and I would say unusually, except it has become usual under the Obama government, the administration that doesn't seem to have control over its own government. This is extremely unusual for what should be not only, a great power, but the world superpower, and it should frighten everyone.
You know, you're a former naval officer, okay? The significance of, being questioned really by, another world leader, whether the White House or the Pentagon is in control. The Pentagon being in control is what the U.S. Constitution essentially was designed to prevent, right? That's something the military is never supposed to do.
Yeah, and this is not, of course, the first such incident. I mean, this is a largely, a continued result that has snowballed from the incoherent U.S. Policy towards Syria, where we have the CIA supporting, their proxies, the Free Syrian Army, Al-Zinki, and these other, so-called moderate terrorists, while the Pentagon has largely stayed away from the Islamists and has instead backed the Kurds, the YPG, and recreated this rebranded Kurdish force with a few Arab tribes thrown in, rebranded them as the Syrian Defense Forces. These two have been fighting for years now. I mean, it blew up most recently with the Turkish invasion at Jarablus in north central Syria with the FSA and Ahrar al-Sham and others in tow, when the Kurds were forced to retreat under U.S. Orders, basically, threats they would stop providing aids to the Kurds. But they've been fighting for years, so that fighting is nothing new. And plenty of Western, mainstream media people have commented that this is essentially the CIA and the Pentagon in proxy war with each other in Syria. And that's crazy. That goes well beyond the limits of a multi-vector foreign policy. This is institutions. What is the chances we special forces assigned to either group have been killed in the course of fighting institutionally led U.S. special forces in Syria? These are things that we will probably never know the answer to, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility, and that's just crazy. This Obama's foreign policy, and there are plenty of people that criticize him, of course, for not intervening, not doing enough, as if a proxy, illegal proxy war where you arm, train, and pay the salaries of extremists to overthrow another government, in flagrant violation of international law, to the tune of billions of taxpayer dollars, and completely organize this fake political opposition in the process,
making 6 million refugees.
It has no relation to the people fighting on the ground.
Yeah.
That is nothing. That is where we're at now. Where our journalists, our foreign policy commentariat, they are more hawkish than the White House, and their claims is that Obama has done that. All of this is nothing, and that is an empire. When you have the elite of a country complaining that everything would have been better if U.S. had just gone straight in and regime the country, as happened previously in Iraq and Libya and so forth, that is, again, it's frightening.
You know,
it should be frightening to everyone.
When I heard Churkin say that about whether the White House or the Pentagon was in control, I had an immediate flashback to this movie, this TV movie that was made back during the Reagan era with Rock Hudson as the U.S. president and Brian Keith as like a Gorbachev-type guy. And there was this steady buildup of tensions. The movie's called World War III, by the way. The steady buildup of tensions, and at this key moment, all of a sudden, Brock Hudson says, "Oh my God, I think they've killed him, and the military's in control." And from there, it went right to the missiles flying. And I heard when I heard that coming out of the UN Saturday, it sent a chill up my spine.
For the last 25 years or so, it has been a Hollywood trope. Also of, you know, military thrillers and so on, of a rogue Russian agents, rogue Russian officers, or rogue Russian government factions, you know, creating some kind of potential World War III situation. Well, here we are in 2016, and the problem we have is of rogue U.S., right, you know, potential rogue U.S. government factions fighting amongst each other under, you know, whether you supported greater action in Syria or none, you know, as I certainly did, a weak president who doesn't have control of his own government and has, you know, basically farmed Syria policy out equally in contradictory ways to the CIA and the Pentagon and the State Department, who don't seem to get along very well with each other. But even these airstrikes distract from what is going on, has been going on with the ceasefire, and that may be intentional. Just in the days before this airstrike, Russia tried to bring another resolution to the Security Council that would incorporate what was agreed on between the U.S. and Russia in a Security Council resolution. The U.S. refuses to make the terms of this deal under Russian protest public.
Right.
They don't reveal it to their own public. They don't reveal it to the other members of the Security Council, which is why no such resolution supporting it could be passed, because the U.S. objected to it. And the Obama administration does not want you to know what is in the five documents that detail this now obviously failed ceasefire agreement. But what is it was perfectly obvious is that one of the terms, one of the primary terms, is that Obama was required to separate his quote-unquote moderate proxies from their jihadist allies. And we're talking very specifically al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, whatever they're calling themselves this day. Even the U.S. government still recognizes their al-Qaeda and all the other groups allied with them, right? We have countless U.S. experts on Syria, and we're talking no friends of Russia or anything like that. We're talking backers of the rebellion, and I'm talking Faisal al-Attani at the Atlantic Council and Sam Heller at the Century Foundation. They have very, you know, they're acknowledged experts on the Syria conflict, and they themselves have pointed out that al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Sham, whatever they're calling themselves, are the dominant umbrella under which most of the other organizations operate, including the Free Syrian Armies, you know, which is not in any way a coherent structure. It's just scattered different brigades, well branded by the U.S. They are embedded within this. They are much smaller. They are embedded within the structures. It goes beyond even terms of what you would consider allies. They you know, allow the U.S. To send special arms, including these advanced TOW anti-tank missiles. They form effectively as human shields, preventing the Russian and Syrian Air Force from striking, because otherwise you hit the moderate rebels.
Right.
And they serve as the PR front.
Right.
And this is, you know, by one flimsy degree of denial, this is the U.S. government of Barack Obama supporting al-Qaeda. You know, not necessarily because he agrees with its ideology, but because he intends, you know, as he previously they, you know, they have attempt to manage ISIS into using it as a battering ram for regime change in Syria. And right. The U.S., Obama has promised Russia since these ceasefires first started this year, to separate his proxies from al-Qaeda and these other groups, you know, that are mostly splinter groups of al-Qaeda. And the U.S. has consistently not done that. And one of the terms of this most recent ceasefire was very explicitly to at least begin the process of doing so. And the constant Russia complaint, again, is not only haven't they separated, but they've actually just used the last week, 9 days to regroup and have reformed together. Now planning to launch offensives in several areas. And in fact, there are is plenty of indication, you know, that actually since the ceasefire began, so-called rebel attacks have actually increased. And this is all meant to distract from that. Now whether the U.S. government knows all of this and is perfectly fine with its happening, with this, and is simply trying to deflect from being unable to live up to the terms of the ceasefire, or whether they actually have no control over their own proxies on the ground at this point, and there's some indication of that. Just recently, these proxies are also supported by Turkey, by Saudi Arabia, and by Qatar, and a large number of them are walking, are in tow with the Turkish army's invasion in north central Syria, Jarablus, which is, of course, now expanding, as I predicted, against a lot of opposition, well over a month ago now, that it would become a safe zone, you know, a long desired safe zone by Erdogan for his proxies in Syria. And that's exactly what he is declaring now.
Yeah, you called that right.
Saying that he intends to expand the territory held from the 900 square kilometers it is now to some 5,000 square kilometers. And this is this important corridor, this gap between mountains where the rat lines that Turkey provides to all of these groups, including the, you know, the outright jihadists that they support, run through. And now they've got a safe haven there where Russia and the Syrian Air Force can't strike, because if they do, there's Turkish military on the ground. So that is a de facto no-fly zone, over Syria's territory. And these FSA groups that are there with Turkey, it also includes other more outright jihadists, such as Zahar al-Sham, an al-Qaeda splinter group, and so on. But they chased off a U.S. Special Forces group last week that was supposed to be advising and, you know, leading them, coordinating with U.S. airstrikes. They chased them off, calling them crusaders and saying that all the Christians need to be driven from Syria, which, of course, we've known this all along. And the ones who did this are U.S. taxpayer, armed, trained, and salaried moderates.
Right. If you look at it through the prism that you're describing of perhaps competing interests in Washington, backing different factions and all of that, and it creating that chaos, you got to look also at what happened in Libya, the difference being really two differences. One, the veto by Russia and China on several occasions of U.S. air war, in essence, styled as a tamp down of the airspace, no-fly zone, and also Russia's direct involvement. But otherwise, it seems that they're happy with the chaos that's created by this, you know, multipolar U.S. policy. It doesn't matter if they have, you know, a bunch of people that can't win. They can't win a ground war anyway without the air cover. We will provide key air cover to keep you guys in the game and go ahead and make chaos. We fight with each other, fight with the government, fight with whoever the hell you want to fight with. Just keep fighting.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities you can draw between Libya, especially, you know, the UK in Libya, the UK and France were presented and were supposed to take the lead. Of course, they were military and capable of this, and very quickly and attemptedly, quietly, the U.S. stepped the role and still provided the majority of the military muscle in the air war. But also Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and to a lesser extent Turkey, were intrinsically involved. And, right. you know, this final attack on Tripoli that toppled the Syrian government.
The Qataris.
This was Qataris. Yeah. Qatari-led, Qatari-trained.
Yeah, their officers were there. They were easily recognizable. And yep.
So, and Qatar and Saudi Arabia, you know, they have their own competing interests. So, you know, that seems a little strange, but certainly they're not always on the same page. They're backing different groups. Turkey is a big player in Syria and backing different groups.
Right.
And you have the U.S. And, you know, it's no secret that, you know, most of these proxies that the U.S. has don't have any agreement in any kind of principle or, right. You know, ideology with the U.S. government.
Or each other.
Them. Yeah, or each other. This is a tool. We've got some thousand, more than 1,000 armed groups. Some of them measuring, only a few dozen people, and some of them with over 10,000. You know, the biggest ones are like Al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham and others. You know, the biggest jihadist groups. So there's so many competing interests at this point. And then, of course, you've got the complication of the Kurds, which have largely avoided any serious conflict with the Syrian government and have actually been supported by the Syrian government and the Russians.
Right.
And the United States.
Right.
Although it must be said that these are different groups of Kurds in different parts of the country at different times. But of course the Turks take great offense to this. And relations between the U.S. government and Turkey are, of course, abysmal at this point. Right? They're really bad. And, you know, I don't believe, I don't think anyone knows exactly what happened with this coup attempt. I don't believe that the CIA was directly involved in any of this. I don't believe the U.S. was involved. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't bear any of the hallmarks. It was far too incompetent for their usual, you know, regime change attempts. But I think Erdogan was simply mad that they sat back and let it happen and didn't make any attempt, to support Erdogan until the writing was already on the wall that he was going to win. So I think his anger is simply at that. But he is now, you know, gone rogue. There was reporting from the Washington Post that with the Turkish incursion of, invasion of northern Syria here, that there were reports from the Wall Street Journal that the U.S. was involved, that they provided air support, that they provided special forces, that they provided drones. There was a view a week later from the Washington Post. They gave another view of this. This is the same, again, creation of a safe zone that had been planned for a year earlier and was prevented, I think, very intentionally by Russia's intervention. This plan was stopped a year ago. Now it has been put back in action and put into realization. But Obama was still hesitating up until the night when it was supposed to be a decision was supposed to be made. And then Turkey jumped the gun and the U.S. scrambled to provide some kind of support to, you know, just say that they were supporting it by the authority of the U.S. general on the ground, controlling these things. And it later the U.S. just tried to present it. And of course, there are good reasons for this. If U.S. Craft and special forces were involved, that would make a reaction from Russia or the Syria government that much more less likely, because it would mean not only going to war with Turkey, a NATO member, but also going to war with the United States as well. Right. But evidently this was last minute. This was Erdogan jumping the gun and pushing Obama when he hadn't fully committed to the act yet. And this is a direct repeat of what happened in Libya when Francis Sarkozy did the same thing and initiated airstrikes before Obama had fully committed. So again and again, the Obama administration has been flat-footed on these interventions by its own you know, nominal allies. But it's no secret that the U.S. and Turkey, our relationship is on the rocks at this point. But there is absolutely no reason to believe that Turkey will leave NATO. I think this is geopolitical fantasies of some people. There's not going to be any term real, any long-term realignment. Turkey is simply doing some balancing. And I think when Clinton comes into office, you'll probably see some kind of reset declared by Erdogan, and, you know, relations patched up, because Turkey is just too dependent on NATO and the EU as a trade partner.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.